So for a few Sunday evenings then, we're in the book of Psalms, and our psalm this evening is Psalm 49. And we encounter in this psalm a rather startling, perhaps even disconcerting, three-word refrain. It appears in verse 12, and it appears in verse 20, and the refrain is this: like the beasts, like the beasts. The refrain is talking about man. And of course, when we think of the Bible's treatment of man, we immediately think in terms of man being radically different from the beasts. We think in terms of a distinction, a profound and unmistakable distinction. But fascinatingly, that's not the emphasis in Psalm 49. It doesn't so much make a distinction between man and beast, not in the first place at least, as draw a comparison between man and beasts. Now, it doesn't go down that route because this is some kind of rogue psalm. It isn't to be pitted against Psalm 8, for instance, with its very high view of man's status. It's just that Psalm 49 is doing something different to Psalm 8. It's making a different point, and so it comes at things from a different direction. Now, let me just make a couple of mention a couple of structural issues before we go any further. So first of all, in terms of the structure of the psalm, it goes like this. We have, first of all, an introduction in verses 1 to 4. And then we have the section that ends with the first, like the beasts, refrain. So that's verses 5 to 12. And then we have the section that ends with the second, like the beasts, refrain. That's verses 13 to 20. So that's the structure of the psalm: introduction, that first section that ends in the refrain, and then that second section that ends in the refrain. And then in terms of the structure of this sermon, the application is going to come at the end. I don't think that this is a psalm we're meant to kind of mine for all sorts of applicatory tidbits. Now, its challenge to us is focused and singular, and as I say, we'll get there once we've followed the route by which the psalm itself wants us to get there. So without further ado, let's explore Psalm 49's rather distinctive comparison between men and beasts. And I would like us to do so under three headings. First of all, a simple comparison. And so we're going to focus, first of all, this evening on that first, like the beasts, refrain, along with the section to which it belongs, so verses 5 to 12. I know we're kind of ignoring the introduction, we'll come to that later on. And according to this first refrain then, there in verse 12, how is man like the beasts? What is the similarity between them? Well, it's this: both men and beasts do not remain. That's the verb used in the refrain. They do not remain. The Hebrew word that we have there is a fairly common one in the Old Testament, and often it's used of lodging somewhere overnight. So you have King Balak's messengers lodging overnight with Balaam, and the word is used there. You have the Israelites lodging overnight beside the Jordan before they cross the river into the Promised Land. The word is used there. You have Elijah lodging overnight in that cave at Horeb, where Yahweh then revealed himself to him in the still small voice. The word is used there too. And we could go through many other examples. But unlike those examples then, here the verb is accompanied, of course, by the word not. So in those other texts, we have overnight lodging being enjoyed by the person or persons in question. Here, on the other hand, we have overnight lodging, if you like, being terminated. They will not remain. When I was maybe 11 or 12, a gang of us from church went and camped a night in the Hambleton Hills on the edge of the North Yorkshire Moors National Park. And so we found a good place, and we set up the tents, and we unrolled the sleeping bags and all the rest of it amidst great excitement. But the excitement was somewhat short-lived. There we were making ourselves at home when suddenly the park warden turned up and informed us in unequivocal terms that we weren't allowed to camp there. And so sleeping bags had to be rolled up again, tents had to be dismantled, rucksacks had to be repacked. We were being kicked off our lodging spots. And that's the picture here then, in verse 12. Except, of course, the lodging spot in this case isn't some piece of grass on the North Yorkshire moors. No, the lodging spot in this case is the world. You see, from the moment that we are conceived, this world is our lodging spot. And some then occupy this lodging spot only for a few weeks or months or years. Many of us in this room have been occupying this lodging spot for several decades now. Some will occupy it, of course, for perhaps 90 years, 100 years at the most. But for all of us, the moment comes sooner or later when we are kicked off our lodging spot, when we can't remain in this world any longer. And the psalmist is saying then that that links us with the beasts. I mean, the impermanence of the beasts is a reality that hardly any of us can miss every day of our lives, whether it's the deer and foxes lying by the side of the busy road, kind of all mangled up, or whether it's the contents of your Sunday dinner this afternoon. Beasts just simply are impermanent. We know that. And this is saying we are in the same category. We are no different from the beasts in that sense. This world is a very temporary lodging spot for us, just as it is for them. And so it's a simple comparison then that we have here. It isn't anthropologically profound, nor is it zoologically profound. Humans and beasts are similar in that neither remains. The comparison is as simple as that. And if that's the refrain then, notice that in the section to which the refrain belongs, in verses 5 to 12 as a whole, the psalmist singles out one particular type of human being, doesn't he? And he really goes to town on how this one type of human being doesn't remain. What type is it? Well, it's wealthy human beings. Now, the point is not that wealthy human beings are even less permanent than other human beings. No, the point is that they could seem to be more permanent. I mean, after all, wealthy human beings are able to buy themselves so many privileges, aren't they? You think of Donald Trump, and if the allegations are true, then he secured through a large monetary payment a non-disclosure agreement to ensure that a woman with whom he had had an affair would remain silent about the affair. Now, in that particular case, something's obviously gone wrong and the silence has been broken. But in principle, at least then, if you are wealthy enough, you can behave scandalously and you can then blithely stave off all the disrepute that would otherwise come your way by simply writing a check and securing a non-disclosure agreement. And if then wealthy human beings are able to do this kind of thing, if they're able to buy for themselves so many privileges, are they not perhaps even able to buy themselves permanence in this world? We might be tempted to think that they can. And that's why then the psalmist singles them out. And he utterly demolishes this idea that the wealthy can buy themselves permanence in this world. In the first paragraph of the section, verses 5 to 9, the demolition is sober and to the point. He says effectively that the price of permanence is just too high. It's too high even for the wealthy to afford. Non-disclosure agreements may be affordable to some, but permanence in this world simply isn't. You can't buy it. No price can suffice, he says in verse 8. It's too costly. But then in the second paragraph of this section, verses 10 to 12, the demolition becomes a bit more wry in its tone, as a kind of dark comedy about these verses. So for one thing, he says that with these wealthy human beings, money will change hands, all right, but not through them paying a sum of money that secures their permanent existence in this world. Rather, through them leaving their wealth to others, verse 10, as they depart this world. And then for another thing, he says that these wealthy human beings, oh yes, they will permanently have land here on earth that's theirs. The only thing is, it's a very small piece of land. It's their burial plot. That's the only piece of land that will remain theirs permanently. And so you get the point then. The psalmist is saying, even the rich who can buy seemingly anything, they can't buy permanence. They can stave off disrepute, perhaps, when they've been messing around with women. They can't stave off departure when their lives have run their course. Now, this comparison between men and beasts, it encompasses them too. The millionaires, the billionaires. It encompasses everyone, all human beings. Economic distinctions don't enter into it, and neither do any other distinctions. It's perfectly simple. Beasts don't remain, and human beings likewise don't remain. So that's the first thing this evening, a simple comparison. But then notice with me, secondly, a deeper comparison. A deeper comparison. And so we move on now to the second like the beast refrain, along with the section to which it belongs. So verses 13 to 20. And in that second refrain, then there in verse 20, we're pointed to a deeper truth about the beasts than that they don't remain. And the deeper truth is this: they have no understanding. They are, he says, without understanding. And I think that in the context, what he means is they have no understanding, the beasts, they have no understanding of the fact they're not going to remain. That's what he means. In other words, it doesn't weigh on them at all. I mean, you watch these documentaries on television about the natural world and these animals then that they film, and they're always ever so busy, aren't they, these animals? You know, they're trying to attract a mate, or they're actually mating, or they're rearing their young, or they're hunting for food, or they're seeking a place to hibernate, or they're sparring with a dangerous rival, or they're building a nest, or building a dam, or building a network of underground tunnels, or whatever it might be. They're always so busy. And yet, amidst all this busyness, these animals, they never stop and think, well, what's this all about? You know, what's the point of all this when someday soon some creature higher up the food chain is going to clamp its jaws around me? Or if that doesn't happen, rising sea levels due to global warming is going to mean that I no longer have an environment and no longer any food to eat. I mean, they never do that, do they? They never stop and think like that. The fact that they are so impermanent never seems to temper or to dampen their engagement with daily life. They live fully absorbed in the moment, investing wholly in every courtship ritual and in every pursuit of prey, as though it had some kind of ultimate significance attached to it. Not a thought that impending death will soon plunge that courtship ritual or that pursuit of prey into total and utter irrelevance. And so that's what the psalmist means about the beast being without understanding. He doesn't mean that they can't get their heads around the finer points of algebra, or they can't get their heads around Shakespeare's plot lines. That's true, of course, but that's not the point he's making. He means they don't live in the light of their impermanence. It just doesn't register in their thinking. So now we've established then what that phrase without understanding means, we're ready to feel the force of this second refrain there in verse 20. And the psalmist is saying here that at this deeper level too, there is a comparison between men and beasts. Just as the beasts don't live in the light of their impermanence, so similarly, he's saying, many human beings don't live in the light of their impermanence. Many human beings are likewise without understanding in this sense. And in the section to which this refrain belongs then, verses 13 to 20, he provides a couple of examples of human beings being kind of intoxicated with their own success. So in verse 13, he talks about those who have this foolish confidence. And in verse 18, he talks about men counting themselves blessed. And he doesn't mean in the sense of thanking God for all their blessings, but as the second half of that verse shows, he means in the sense of allowing the praise of others to go to their heads. And you would have thought then that a sense of brevity, a sense of mortality, a sense of impermanence would be a powerful antidote to such intoxication. That the inevitability of their departure from this world in a few decades' time at the most would keep their feet firmly on the ground. But no, the psalmist is saying, many human beings pursue wealth and celebrate wealth and despair at losing wealth as though everything hangs on it. As though they are going to live in this world forever, not a thought of impending death rendering the whole project irrelevant. They are without understanding. And it's not just amongst the wealthy and the successful that we see this, is it? We see this absence of understanding, this failure to live in the light of our impermanence. We see it in ordinary folk, don't we? Amongst whom we mix. You see it in the way that people react when someone dies. And all the funny ideas and sensibilities that surface in those moments. When our neighbour died a few weeks ago, another neighbour got annoyed because another neighbour still dared to park her car in the dead man's driveway. As though this was just the height of moral outrage, the height of disrespectfulness. All these funny ideas that surface. But there's one thing that you rarely hear people say in those circumstances. And it's this. Wow, this is sobering. This is going to happen to me one day too. You never hear people say that, do you? All these funny ideas that surface, but never, this should make me think. I'm going to end up in a wooden box as well. It's the obvious reaction you'd have thought, but you rarely encounter it because the psalmist is saying men are like the beasts. Without understanding, they don't live in the light of their impermanence. So, a simple comparison, a deeper comparison. But then thirdly, notice with me, A limited comparison. So someone might say in response to this, well, what is to be gained by dwelling on our impermanence anyway? I mean, we may as well make the best of life and try to forget our mortality and get on with things. What's the point in being all morose about it? It won't change anything. It's better to be like the beasts and to live absorbed in the moment. Well, in answering that question, we need to kind of change tack a bit. So far this evening, we've been going to town on this comparison between men and beasts and how considerable that comparison is. And it's right that we've done that because that comparison is important. And as you've seen, it's a major part of this psalm. But at this point, we must confront the limitations of the comparison. In my introduction, I referred to this refrain that we have in verses 12 and 20 as being a three-word refrain. Actually, it's not a three-word refrain, is it? It's a five-word refrain. It's not simply like the beasts. It's like the beasts that perish. And I think we need to understand that is not another way of saying that the beasts don't remain. Of course, we've seen, he says that in verse 12, that the beasts don't remain, and we saw that they have that in common with us. We don't remain either. This perishing, however, is something beyond that. This is a strong word. This means stop existing, going out of existence. And that is not something that the beasts have in common with men. So I hope you get what I'm saying. Both men and beasts get kicked off this lodging spot, to use my earlier language. Both men and beasts have to depart this world. But when the beast departs, they perish. They go out of existence. When human beings depart, on the other hand, they don't perish. And the psalmist elaborates on this in one very key part of the psalm, and it's verses 14 and 15. So what does he say then about human beings there? Well, he says in verse 14, they are appointed for Sheol. They are appointed for Sheol. What is Sheol? Well, Sheol in the Old Testament is the realm of the dead. In Sheol you have died. You're in death, if you like. But it's not a state of non-existence. You still have a form of existence there. So human beings, he says, on departing this world, unlike the beasts, they don't perish. They're not cut off. They don't go out of existence. Human beings, rather, on departing this world, they are shepherded into Sheol. That's the imagery at the start of verse 14. And that, by the way, is why he says, like sheep, they are appointed for Sheol. His point is not that some beasts, namely sheep, do live on after death. They go to Sheol as well. No, the point of the sheep is this shepherding metaphor. So just as sheep are shepherded, so human beings on death are shepherded by death, that's the picture, into this new chapter of existence, into Sheol. And what happens then? Well, it seems from the psalm that there are two possible outcomes. And the key phrase really to notice is in verse 15, those four words, the power of Sheol. That's the key phrase, the power of Sheol. So there's outcome one. And outcome number one is being rescued from the power of Sheol. That's what he's talking about in verse 15. To what precisely is he referring? What is this rescue from the power of Sheol? Well, I think he can only be referring here to resurrection on the last day. This is an Old Testament glimpse far, far, far into the future toward a point that we haven't even reached yet. The day of resurrection at the end of time. For one thing, notice he uses that interesting phrase in verse 14, the morning. And in both Testaments, Old and New, the morning is associated with Resurrection Day. So you have in several Old Testament texts, Resurrection Day being described in terms of awaking. In Psalm 17, Daniel 12, or Isaiah 26, I think probably Psalm 139, you have these references to people awaking on Resurrection Day, which fits with this reference to mourning. And then for another thing, this language of being rescued from the power of Sheol, did you notice it was also there in our opening text this evening? I opened this evening's service with a couple of verses from Hosea 13, where you have again Yahweh talking about rescuing from the power of Sheol, And of course we know especially from our present Sunday morning series that Paul quotes Hosea 13 in 1 Corinthians 15 and quotes it in relation to Resurrection Day. So I think the psalmist here, when he talks about this first possible outcome for human beings, having been shepherded by death into Sheol, the first possible outcome is that one day, on Resurrection Day, they will be rescued by God from the power of Sheol. Now, you might say, well, hang on a minute. Is it not our hope as believers that when we die, we shall be immediately rescued from the power of Sheol and immediately go into the presence of Christ? Well, yes, it is our hope that upon death we shall immediately go into the presence of Christ. But I don't think that's quite the same as being rescued from the power of Sheol. There's a sense in which throughout that period from our death until Resurrection Day, we are still under the power of Sheol because we're still in the realm of death. We're existing, and we're existing consciously, and we're existing happily in the presence of Christ, but we're still in the realm of death, and it's only on Resurrection Day that this rescue that has been described here from the power of Sheol will take place. And so what a glorious outcome that is. This is one possible outcome for human beings. None of us can remain. We all must be shepherded from this life. But one possible outcome is that on Resurrection Day, we will then be rescued from the power of Sheol. What's the other possible outcome? Well, outcome number two is by implication, remaining forever under the power of Sheol. Never been rescued. I don't mean by that then that for some human beings there is a state of annihilation. We've said only the beasts are annihilated. I don't even mean that those who remain in the power of Sheol won't be resurrected, because there are texts that indicate all human beings are going to be resurrected. But those who, in the terms of this psalm, remain in the power of Sheol, they will be resurrected on that last day, but to a deathly kind of existence. So that they're still in the realm of death forevermore. In every sense. Death in the sense that their souls are dead because not in communion with the God who made them for himself. And dead in the sense that their resurrection bodies will be hideous resurrection bodies, not the glorious, beautiful things that Paul describes in 1 Corinthians 15 that will be the inheritance of believers. And so this is a terrible outcome. This is a terrible prospect. Never being wiped out, but living forever in the realm of death. Living forever a deathly existence, spiritually and bodily. That's outcome number two. And so then, it's because the comparison actually, at the end of the day, between beasts and men is a limited comparison. Because whereas beasts perish, humans don't. It's because of that that understanding is so necessary. This is why we must live with a sense of our impermanence. Because if we live like the beasts, just absorbed in the moment, living for today, eating and drinking and being merry, then we will suddenly find that we are being shepherded by death into this terrible eternity, this terrible endless state that we've just described. And this is my application then. Remember I said the application of this psalm is single and focused. And this is the application. The application is, live with understanding. Notice that's what the introduction is about, isn't it? He begins, hear this, all peoples. What does he want all peoples to hear? Well, he says in verse 3, my mouth shall speak wisdom, the meditation of my heart shall be understanding. This is what he wants the world to take away from this psalm, understanding. He wants people to live in the face of their impermanence, not like the beasts, unaware, oblivious, ignorant, but he wants people to live in the face of their mortality and their impermanence, understanding this, seeing it for what it is, recognizing it. But of course, we must go a little bit further than that, mustn't we? Because mere understanding by itself isn't enough. I mean, I've said tonight that we meet many human beings who just don't even acknowledge that they're going to die and that they're impermanent. But of course, there are other human beings who do acknowledge that. And some of the most sobering and sober literature about death has been written, of course, by people who aren't believers. So you can have understanding. You can be unlike a beast and recognize that we are impermanent, and yet still, that won't necessarily benefit you. You need to go beyond mere understanding. And I suppose we finally need to ask this question, don't we? What is it that determines then whether we shall experience outcome one or outcome two? What is it that determines whether we shall, on resurrection day, be rescued from the power of Sheol, or whether we shall instead live everlastingly this deathly existence still in the power of Sheol? What's the difference between the two camps? Well, here we need to notice that actually I've been using the word rescue. That's not the word that the psalmist uses in verse 15, is it? It's a more specific word. It's ransom. God will ransom my soul. I don't think my soul is a great translation. I think in this instance means my life. God will ransom my life from the power of Sheol. What's ransom mean? What is a ransom? Well, a ransom is a payment, and we know that from earlier in the psalm, from verse 7. It's clearly a payment there. Same word. A ransom is a payment. So, a person will be rescued from the power of Sheol on that last day in resurrection if a ransom has been paid for that person. What possibly could that ransom be? Well, of course, I don't need to tell you, there's only one possible ransom, isn't there? The great ransom at the heart of the Bible story. The blood of Jesus Christ. That's the ransom that pays for a person to be rescued from the power of Sheol on the last day. And so, to come back to what I was saying a moment ago, yes, the most basic thing you and I need in the face of our impermanence is understanding. That's the first step. We need to understand we are impermanent. We're all mortal. We're all going to be kicked off our lodging spots. But we need to go beyond mere understanding. And we need to be trusting in the blood of Jesus Christ, the only ransom that has been paid that people can be set free on resurrection day from the power of Sheol. That's what determines which camp you're in. Nothing else. Nothing else at all. Just whether or not you are trusting in the ransom, Jesus Christ. Are you trusting in that ransom tonight? Sounds like such a bland question, but everything hangs on that question. Everything. Whether you are in camp one or camp two hangs on that question. Whether glorious resurrection life is your future, or whether a state of endless death, endless, conscious, hideous, horrible death is your future. It all comes down to this. Are you trusting in the ransom? Are you trusting in the payments that God made at such cost to himself 2,000 years ago at Calvary, where he dug into his pockets and paid with blood, his son's blood, that men and women and boys and girls might be set free on the last day? Please, if you're not yet trusting, come and trust tonight in the ransom that is Jesus Christ. Amen.